That's what basically. Anyway, today I wanted to talk about a thing that's been bugging me and probably everybody for, perhaps most of the time we've been building things with computers. And, of course, that is that almost everything we build is rather brittle. Okay? And what do we really mean? What do we mean by robust if we want to make robust things? To me, robustness is a very specific idea. It's not about reliability. It's about something even better than reliability. It's about being able to make things that have the property that when you use them, you may use them in ways that the designer didn't intend or even had no idea about. Okay? And so really there's this question of how do we manufacture systems, whatever kind, both software and hardware and whatever, that have this property of robustness that is pretty elusive. And I would like to address that today. And of course, people have always worried about this a bit. Certainly there are lots of organizational theories that people have. Things like, here's some list of them. There's the famous discipline of programming, which I think has done a great deal of damage to the engineering. This is one of those theories where you have careful specifications, strong typing, proofs of correctness, model-based testing, all that sort of stuff, okay, most of which I believe has actually caused serious damage, and I'll explain that later. Okay? You're looking at me real weird, right? Yes, Henry, I see. Henry, you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are things like object-oriented programming, functional programming, rule-based expert systems, logic-based programming, constraint-based programming, all of these things, well, maybe we call them theories, but actually they may very well be religions, okay? Okay. Okay. And what I mean by that is that they have the special property that religions often have, which is they're exclusive. Now, if you want to do something one way, then by golly, you're prevented from doing something some other way in the same system. That in fact, these things don't really, in any reasonable sense, interoperate. Another way to think about that is that there's sort of a bug. The bug is that the organizational ideas, each one entails certain ontological commitments that make it difficult to interoperate with other parts of a system that may be appropriate to organize in different ways. So if you think about an object-oriented system, it may prevent you from, for example, writing some other part of the system as a rule-based system. Okay, and to work with it very well. And so what we really want is to have ways of not forcing on one part, the ontological commitments required to make one part of a system work well on another part of a system. But we want to kind of additivity. And there are ideas about that. Of course, for those of you who've been reading the literature, there's Gregor Cazales, made up a thing called aspect-oriented programming, which, of course, scares the hell out of all the software engineers. And it's sort of wonderful because it's one of those things that at least is additive. Okay? It doesn't mean that everything, I'm not going to say that's the answer to the world's problems, but it's the kind of thing you're looking for. Things whereby, after everybody's done what they've done, you still can change the system by doing something to it that did not change any of the code that's already there, okay, basically. And are there general ways to make systems in which interchangeable parts interoperate correctly? This is a really interesting kind of question. We certainly know that there are systems in the world of engineering that are not brittle in the way that most of the systems we build are. There are things like the internet. There are things like cities. Okay, how do we... cities are pretty interesting, right? When's the last time we had to shovel up the horse shit in New York? Okay, or the dead horses? Okay, so it's a very different world. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about right now is ideas about how to do that. And I'm going to start out with I'm teaching a class now, which is basically about this idea. It's an advanced symbolic programming class for MIT undergraduates and graduate students. And if you want to look on the web, you'll find it under my webpage. I'm teaching with Chris Hansen. There's a pointer to it, which has got a lot of code and things like that for people who might want to look at it. But in any case, in this class, we're trying to figure out how to do that kind of thing in general. So one particular example that I started with was a thing from good old Joel Moses many years ago, invented a way of doing symbolic integration. A very different way from the very first way to do it was by the kind of way a freshman calculus student does it. That's Saint by Slagle way back in the early 60s, 62, I suppose. That was basically search in a complicated way. Then Moses invented something which was a little bit more clever, more like what a professional mathematician does, which is kind of pattern matching in a nice way on the shapes of the expressions. And that was pretty successful. Eventually, of course, people made algorithms for doing this, like the Risch algorithm, although I have to admit that that's enormously complicated and very difficult to understand, and you don't get any insight about how people think if you look at that. It's not about how people think. It's the same way that, you know, the chess program that beats the world champion is not the way the world champion works, apparently. But in any case, Moses is closest to that. Anyway, I'm not going to show you a piece of Moses code. It's awful. It's in Lisp-tran, meaning it's Fortran written in Lisp. And so, you know, there's a thing called the derivative divides heuristic, which is about... it's about 20 pages long. It's one long prog with go-tos in to all different places and set cues. And it's insane. It shows you how smart the guy was, right? I mean, the fact that he could write a program that worked is just amazing. Anyway, here's the a more modern way to write this. This is the entire derivative divides heuristic. Let me explain what this is first of all. What this is that the integral of c times rho of u of x du of x dx, for those of you who remember this sort of stuff, dx equals c times integral rho of y dy, where y equals u of x. Okay? This is a nice old simple rule for integration, and there's, you know, about a few of these that have catch a lot of the correct answers quickly. It's not quite the same thing as getting everything, okay? But it's very easy to get these, and you have to look for them. And so here's a rule, okay? And I'm going to talk about rules for a second, not because I'm going to say rules are the right answer to any problem as usual. It's just one tool in your toolkit. And it should be able to interoperate with everything else. But I want to read this rule to you a little bit. Okay? This rule is saying that I'm looking for this is a pattern. Then there's some case here which is a test that better be either true or false that says whether or not this rule runs. So if the pattern matches and then this test is true, then I do a substitute on this this skeleton, and that produces a result. Okay? The resulting algebraic expressions. Now, whether you like this language or not, it's got lots of parentheses. That's your problem. Okay, everything I deal with has parentheses. But what this is actually saying is the integral, and this is actually asking about a little bit more general thing. If something which is divided by a d, there's a division here, star, this is multiplied by an elementary function called rho, which is of an argument called ux, where x occurs in u of x, and the rest of the other factors are over here. Okay. First of all, already you're seeing something interesting about this pattern. First of all, what's this slash, slash, and star, star, and things like that? Those are not programs. Those are not patterns that are looking for an explicit multiply. What they're saying, can this match the thing? Is this interpretable as a multiply? Okay. So this is, and what that might mean, for example, is, oh yes, could I factor it into two parts? Or is it something which is an exponential, like a square, and I can multiply it out? Okay. So that's can I interpret something as a multiply? Can I interpret something as a division? Of course I can. And then the derivative denominator could have been one. There's a certain amount of imagination that this program has to have in order to do that. We'll talk about that in a minute. That's sort of interesting in itself. So this is what's called a semantic match, okay, not a syntactic match. But then once you've done this, then the next thing you say is, well, let's simplify the result of a symbolic division of another symbolic division of the other factors divided by d, divide out the derivative, okay, simplify that, bind that to c, and if x does not occur in c, then this passes this test. That's basically saying that if I were to actually compute this for some u, then divide it out, by golly, I get something that looks more like this. Okay? This happens to be an elementary function, so I can look up the elementary integral, substitute for its argument in the elementary integral the u of x, and then I multiply that by c, and I'm done. Okay, so that's what this says. Okay? Now, why did I bring this, show this rule to you? Two reasons. One reason is that what you're seeing here is this is not a piece of the rule language. This stuff over here is not a piece of the rule language, although it refers to rule variables. Right? This over here is refers to some very complicated other language code. Okay, a scheme code, perhaps. There's a simplifier somewhere. There's a symbolic multiply and divide, or add divides are here. Okay, we're of course referring to rule variables here. Derivative is a program from somewhere else. It might have been written in rules or not. I don't know. Okay? And that the substitution part of it is in one language and parts in another. Very interesting. This is interoperating. Okay? But better than that, one thing you don't really see here is the rule itself is a procedure in a scheme, which operates on an expression returning its instantiated template. Okay, so this is I'm not trying to say you write things like this. I'm saying this is an example of a way you can make things that fit together in the right way by having coherence at the language boundaries, at the interface between various pieces. And I'm going to be a little bit more explicit about this. Let me show you something that's real fun. Okay? I'm sorry if you're afraid of math, this is not the place for you. Okay? But we'll get into engineering shortly. Okay? So here's remember completing the square? How many of you remember how to complete a square? Oh boy, isn't that fun, right? Okay, well, here's the game. The game is that if we find something that looks like ax squared plus bx plus c, we want to realize that that's really a times x minus b over 2a squared plus c minus b squared over 4a. Right? That's what it is. There's a little formula that says now I've got the thing in form of a square, okay, and then with something added to it. Okay, well, that's part of the solution of a quadratic equation. I'm not very interested in why it's a good idea. You use it all the time in manipulations of algebra. The important thing here is that, again, this is full of these very interesting semantic match devices. This is sums, products. Can I interpret something as a sum? Well, sure, if it's a product of things, I might multiply it out. Okay? And things like that. I can interpret it that way, and eventually I have to fill in the details, and by golly, completing the square on something complicated like 2x plus 3 plus 2x squared y. Notice that this is not even in any particular order. Okay, this is just saying I want here something that looks like the variable squared multiplied by something which the variable does not occur in, and it's not 0, so that's the a. Okay. And that has got to be added to something which is the variable times a b, which the variable does not occur in. And the rest of all the terms in this addition have to be something that can be interpreted as a c, which the variables do not occur in. So it's got to look at that's what that addition thing has to also know about the commutative and associative laws and things like that. That's interesting. It's a very complicated program, you see. I'll tell you how to write that too, because that turns out to be an interesting other thing shortly. But in any case, so this is not even in the obvious form. Furthermore, it's got a variable y, which is going to end up being part of one of the constants here. And indeed, it's 2y is a. It's interpreted as x plus y over 2 is the thing that's squared, okay, as you can see. And so there's a completing the square device. Okay. So why am I showing you this? Okay, well, part of the thing going on here is how would you even begin to write something like this? How do you write a semantic matcher? It's another layer of complexity. Okay? Well, it turns out that there's some very fundamental things we don't ordinarily do in our programming. We don't make things out of mix and match parts very well. And it turns out matchers and other lots of programs can be made out of mix and match parts so they can be added to easily. There's a thing called a combinator, which I suppose many of you have heard of. If you've learned elementary computer science or logic, you might have heard of S's and K's, which are the horrible idea. Okay, I'm not advocating them in the slightest. But what a combinator is a program that has the property that makes other programs from programs. okay, such that they have standardized interfaces and then can be put together. And I'm not going to be any further than that. There are great ideas like this occur in the kind of engineering we do for electrical engineering. Paul Penfield made a beautiful program called Martha, written in APL, I suppose around 1970, where you built arbitrary electrical circuits out of all of these combinators. And it turns out you can do anything if you have those combinators. Okay? This is a port-based idea. Okay? So here's the kind of cascade of two things, or parallel in and parallel out, or parallel in, series out. Okay, things like that. Okay, it turns out that's universal. Right? You can build anything that's a wiring diagram out of things like that, with some primitive ones that look sort of like this. Right? End of story, right? For those of you who remember that sort of thing, that's the sort of thing you like. Well, we have things like, by the way, that was said by Abraham Lincoln first. Okay, this is something that's for those people who like this sort of thing. I can't remember exactly who said it, but it was very nice. Anyway, so I copied from him. Anyway, there are functional combinators. You see, there are very common ones. Like, for example, here's a couple that I've put down here. There's things like composition. What is composition? Composition is this. Okay, so what is it? F composed G of X is F of G of X, right? So this is a new function called the composition of two functions. It corresponds to a diagram, because all these really are wiring diagrams, where there is F, G, and here's the composition, F composed G. Okay? And there are lots of things like that. I mean, there are zillions of combinators that are useful. I've got one here, the parallel combine, which does various interesting things. I use things like this all the time. I'll explain why. There's more of them, right? I'm not out to give you lots of these things, but it turns out the way that the matcher is built out of these combinators, which are match combinators. And I'll show you some of them. And this is an idea that goes way back. The very first description of such an idea, I think, was in Carl Hewitt's completely incomprehensible PhD thesis of 1969, where he was worrying about matcher languages. And unfortunately, it was an incomprehensible thesis, and I didn't understand it until I was much older. Okay, but I learned a great deal from him. Here's some examples of these. And I'm not going to show you the actual structure of the insides of them, but remember that what we have here is, for example, these are various. If I want to match a pattern constant, then I produce a procedure called equivalence match, which happens to know the constant, and it checks to see whether the data is the constant, and otherwise it succeeds and eats up one object. I don't want to talk about why it eats one object. Okay? There's a thing like this, a variable thing that matches a variable. There's a little compiler that compiles these into some big mess. Okay? But there's those patterns. But this is a thing of the same shape. Okay? It takes a data, a dictionary, and a success continuation. Okay? Then the segment variable, that's something that eats many things in a list. Okay? So that might be all the rest of the terms in a sum or something. It has the same thing, a data, a dictionary, and a success continuation. A list has that sort of thing. Okay? All of those things are there. So they all fit together, and therefore they can be mixed and matched, because they're all the same kind of object. They have the same kind of a result as well. Okay? And indeed, let me get back to a second. Yes, okay, here's where I am. Got it. Okay, so that these things get compiled. Okay? So you start with the syntax of a pattern, like this, and it by some magic data-directed mechanism, you have pattern keywords, like the question mark or whatever, or the question mark you saw, or things like that. Okay, but the crucial thing is that there's little programs that are being generated, which contain in them the things that say, I'm going to match these in a particular way, such that if you look at how this syntaxes out, let's take a very simple pattern here, which is something like an associative law, but I put in a test that doesn't matter, just so you can see how that works. It compiles into a rule, a structure, which is basically a combination of combinators, each of which returns the appropriate kind of procedure, which is then run in the right way when they paste together dynamically. Okay, so this is a kind of very extensible system because I can add new combinators without changing the old ones so long as I made the rules. I can add new syntaxes by attaching them with the appropriate compiler syntax to connection. The details of how I'm doing it, this is too fast for me to talk about it here. There's too much of it. This would have to be, you'd have to take my class, but or you can read this code online. Okay, it's there. Everything is online free. But indeed, the idea is that this is sort of super extensible. And it has nothing to do with pattern languages. It has to do with something deeper. It's a philosophy of building things. In fact, what is a combinator? A combinator is sort of like a body plan, okay, for a creature. Here's some nice creatures. This one I saw in Vermont. I see the slide didn't come out so nice. He's all speckled, but he's actually not that speckled. That frog and me are almost the same. That is, we're vertebrates. We have a standardized body plan. The body plan is specified by something called Hox genes, okay, which specifies the fact that there are compartments that start at the tip of my nose and end at my tail, and then the particular order of those compartments is determined by these genes. And what they say is that they modify what can happen in those compartments in development time. Okay? But what actually happens in those compartments depends upon the details that are not written into the Hox genes. Okay, so that's a sort of interesting thing. If I look at something like tensors, there's a combinator for how tensors work. Okay. It's got a very similar sort of thing. There is a thing that takes arguments in, n plus m of them, splits n of them to one tensor, m to the other, and then combine them, and that's sort of how tensors are multiplied. Okay. So the arguments could be, for example, one forms and vectors or whatever. Okay, that's the standard way you pass into things to tensors. A tensor is a multilinear function on one forms and vectors. Body plans are not unusual in engineering. We do things like that all the time. For those of you who are electrical engineers or ham radio operators, you know what that is. Okay, that's a pretty standard body plan called a superheterodyne radio receiver. It was invented by Mr. Edwin Armstrong way back in 1928, I think. That's right, something like that. It's a trick, which I'm not going to explain to you why it's a good idea, but almost every radio receiver in the world is built this way. Okay. This one happens to have instantiated in it the fact that it's an audio receiver. It could have been a video amplifier and a display sitting there. It could have been that the detector, I didn't say what it was. It could have been FM or AM, or it could be something else. Okay? I didn't say anything about this converter object. It might itself be recursive. I might make several of them, making a multi-conversion radio receiver, for a communications receiver. Okay? The body plan itself is this thing that has places where you put in the things you want to do, but they satisfy this constraint they will fit together correctly. That they in fact have the standardized interfaces that fit with their neighbors, and this is so the engineering has been doing this for a long time. It's unfortunately not true about the way we do things in the programming world, and I sort of feel bad about that. Well, how do we fill in a body plan? Let's talk a little bit about the mechanisms. I'm going to make sure I'm talking fast enough. Okay. Well, let's see. Okay, there's a number of tricks here. One of the things is we usually write our programs much too tightly. Let me show you a nice idea. This is invented by nature a billion years ago. That's a eukaryotic cell. You're made out of things like that. It's got a nucleus and stuff like that. But you see all this stuff? These are microtubules. Okay? And the way in which the cell decides to have a shape, or at least is that these microtubules do a random growth from some central organizing spot in the cell, and they grow out in all directions. And they're continuously growing and shrinking. because they're basically an unstable, or actually marginally stable, protein polymer of little units that paste themselves together and make this rigid rod, and then they get eaten up. And it takes energy to do that. They're continuously growing and shrinking. And some of them hit stabilizing places on the cell membrane, and then they stick. And then they become rigid and hold and control the shape of the cell for a while. Okay, so for example, a neuron, it's possible for a neuron to be 3 feet long and start in your spine and end up working in some muscle in your toe, your big toe. Actually, there are no muscles in your big toe. Say your calf over here or something. Is there muscles in the big toe? I don't think so. But anyway, maybe I'm wrong. Because they're pulled by tendons. And I think they're up here in the calf. Okay, but I forgot how that works exactly. I don't think there's much room in there for a muscle. And then a finger or a toe. But in any case, the way that's done is, of course, these neurons, for example, like to talk to near their neighbors, other neurons and muscle fibers, if they're the kind that's programmed for that. Okay? Well, they touch various things, and then they sort of, that one feels good. That's a friend of mine. By golly, he stimulates a material on my cell membrane that's going to stabilize some microtubules that are going to hold me there. Okay? And that's sort of how that works. Okay, and that's an interesting process because it's an exploratory process. Okay, it's a process which is where it's separating the mechanism of holding the shape from the mechanism for deciding what the shape is. Okay? Anytime we can figure out ways to separate things like that, of course we do that all the time in development, also in biology. This hand you see is an interesting thing. It's got about a billion little creatures in it that are all cooperating. But the interesting thing here is that the stuff between here is gone, right? It turns out in development there was these webs and things. It was all one big pad, and then it's all disappeared. Okay, those cells decided to die on purpose. They were programmed to do so. Okay, but that's again an exploratory phenomenon. You build out the right shape, and then you get rid of all the stuff that doesn't quite fit it. Pretty useful, interesting thing. Let me tell you about another creature, and then I'm going to get into this a little deeper. Okay, but before I do that, let me just tell you about other ways to program. You see, here's a nice kind of programming technique that's exploratory. Okay, this is using McCarthy's AMB operator. For those of you who don't know what AMB operator is, AMB is an operator of, say, A, B, and C. This is either A or B or C, but I don't know which. It's ambiguous. Okay, so it's specifying specifying that the answer that I've got here is one of those. Okay? Very interesting kind of thing. McCarthy invented it, I suppose, way back in 1960 or something, because he was investigating non-deterministic automata. Didn't really have anything to do with programming. Eventually, people decided that there might be ideas like backtracking in systems and things like that. But the crucial idea there is a way of doing exploratory behavior. And now, of course, exploratory behavior may be expensive. It may be that you end up in exponential searches. We have to be careful about that. But if we can localize it, so just for a little piece of code, there might be a search that's relevant, and then another place is an independent search, then we've got something. How do we organize things like that? Okay, so that's already an interesting idea. For example, let me give you an example of this. Supposing I'm writing some big numerical program that does some complicated piece of mechanics, like I do that all the time. I teach an advanced classical mechanics class in the fall terms. Well, there are square roots. Square roots have two answers. Square roots in computers only seem to have one. Okay, they're the positive square root. But you know, often when you take a square root, it turns out you don't know which one you need until 15 minutes of computation later, you say, that was the wrong one. Okay? I really want the other one. Now, I don't want to, at that point, have to realize that all that pile of code between the square root that's causing me trouble and the answer that I've got that didn't turn out to be the right one, like I'm going, you know, this thing's going through the ground, right? This object that I was supposed to fly like this, okay, went that way. Okay, the code, I don't want that code to know that the square root has two possible answers, because that code is just doing trajectory manipulations. It doesn't care. Okay? I don't want there to be a loop structure there that I have to see. I want to separate out the fact that the square root has two possibilities from the program that says, given the possibility, what to do with it. Okay? That is a, and that's where this AM business is a good idea. Okay? We gotta be very careful about it. Well, here's a nice example. Pythagorean triples. I squared plus J squared equals K squared. How do we find them? Well, what I want is an integer called I, and an integer for starting at the low value here, and another integer starting at I from called J, and another one called K, and I'm going to require that to be the case. And then if I got one, I'm going to put out I, J, and K. What a nice idea. Okay, well, I have to say what require is. If some predicate is not true, then I want something that can't be satisfied. That just says there are no possibilities here. Okay? And an integer from low to high, from starting with low value, is either the low value or an integer starting from the increment of that. Now, I better be able to, I can't do a depth first strategy here because I'll be in trouble. Okay? So I say with a breadth first schedule, print out the Pythagorean triples and then fail so I get the next one. Because this thing's going to do some searching. And so that's what I'm seeing. Okay, it's a program. How do you arrange things like that? We'll talk about that sometime, maybe in a different world, not in here, but maybe in my classes. Okay, it's easy to write programs like this. There's a version of this in SICP in chapter 4. That's a simple kind. There's also ones that can be easily integrated with any other system. But what we're talking about is this basic idea. Okay, the idea is that we're breaking the modules up into generate and test, if you want to think of it in a sequential manner, or we've got filtering noise. It's a very useful way to think about things in engineering. Okay, filtering noise is often a good idea. And of course, that's what this cell was doing, as you could see. Okay. But I want to tell you a better story than that. Okay. Here's a very interesting frog. Okay. This particular frog is called Gastrothica rhea bombay, and he was discovered about 25 years ago by Delpino and Ellenson somewhere in Central America. And they say, this frog is different from almost every other frog in the world, except it looks just like a frog. Okay? For those of you who have another name for it, what's it? It's called a... I can't remember the non-Latin name for it. Marsupial tree frog. Okay. Anyway, I don't know why they call it that. But anyway, this fellow has the feature that, you know, when you were in high school, you probably looked at some frog's eggs developing under a microscope. Okay, and you saw these little round things that would divide in various ways. They would cleave, and after a few hours, you end up with a tadpole. That's pretty impressive. It would be very nice that that happens. Okay? Well, this guy does the same thing, of course, except it turns out that the mode of development is completely different from almost any other frog. It turns out that this guy produces a flat embryo on a yolk sac like a chick, as opposed to a spherical embryo like say, your local leopard frogs or a bullfrogs. And now, this is very interesting because it turns out that the embryonic tissues that combine to make the organs are not the same ones. But it's got all the same. The adult looks just like any other frog. You cut it up, it looks like any other frog. Right? It's got all the same parts in all the same places. It's the standard body plan. Okay? Probably not. Also, if you looked at its genetics, you would find it was probably no more different from other frogs than we are from horses. So that's pretty. They're pretty close. So how the hell does this happen? This is very interesting. It means that the specification how to make a frog is not by specifically describing what steps to do to make a frog, but rather what constraints have to be satisfied in the construction that you produce by various experiments. If you mix up the cells in an appropriate way, you're going to get a frog in this case, okay, if at the appropriate time in the beginning. That's telling us something that we have to learn how to do that. We have to learn how to write programs like that. That would be a beautiful thing to learn how to write. I'm really into that. I love it. Okay. Anyway, by the way, just to go back to the derivative divides thing, let me show you how you do that with AMP just for a second. And then I want to go on to worrying about what we do about these frogs. Okay. So here's an alternative way to make a derivative divides thing, actually a little more general. Okay? What's going on, I'm not going to write the whole program, this doesn't fit on a single overhead transparency. But I want to find an expression of the integrand of the form rho of u of x, where the rho is an elementary function. Elementary function means things like sine. Okay? And u of x is an expression that contains x. Divide the integrand by that if the quotient c is independent of x, when otherwise and the integral is this, otherwise backtrack. That's the words that would be inside this program. This program has a thing that's an a sub-expression, like we saw an integer. This is a sub-expression that it, where the variable occurs in. Okay? Well, that's interesting. A sub-expression is an easy thing to write. See, it's a thing that says it's an expression of this thing, which is if it's acceptable by some predicate, which is this, then that's what I'm looking for. It's either that or an element of that expression, where an element, or if it's not acceptable, then you have to look at the elements of it, where an element is something which says, look at all the pieces. And this is, again, a choices. So that generates all the sub-expressions, and it's a very elegant way to write this program. And it's short, too. It ends up being about a page. Okay. Okay. So it's the right place here. So the question is, how do we write programs that are partly based on specifications of what is to be made rather than how to do it? That doesn't mean you have to say how to do it too, but you have to say a specification of what is to be made, and that's a part of the dynamically operating piece of code. Well, there are some ideas. One idea that I've been pushing for some years, and I like a lot, is again things where one of those religions you saw on the original slide. Okay, it's talking about things called constraints. Again, as a sort of a hardware engineer type guy, here's a description of a resistor. Okay. Now notice it's written in some language that looks very familiar. It looks very much like a Lisp. Okay, but the pieces here that you're seeing here, these pieces are not objects that have values, okay, for given arguments. What those are little boxes like this. See, this is a specification of a box which has three inputs, such that if you know this one and this one, you get that one. If you know this one and this one, you get that one. If you know this one and this, whatever. Okay? They're all possible directions of computation. You can think of these as if you know how to make data flow machines. Imagine it's a data flow, there are three overlapping data flow devices that are pointed in all three directions with a special thing that says if this guy is getting the same value that's already there with the same token, then ignore it. That's what it is. Okay, so that's what this little guy is. And there are a bunch of them here. They can be abstracted. And by the way, this is a language just like any other. What makes something a language is that the pieces, when combined, make bigger things that have the same type. TTL is an example of that, right? If you combine pieces of TTL, you make something that obeys the TTL conventions. It's got pins that stick out. Electronics is like that. Okay, why don't we write our programs like that? That's sort of interesting. But this is a kind of thing that, again, it can be made to interoperate with all other kinds of programs if done right. Okay, and there are some wild things you can do once you can do that. Okay, but now I'm going to get very controversial, okay? Because I'm going to tell you something that's going to get all of the computer scientists mad, very angry. Okay? I've already alluded to this. It has to do with the problem with proving properties of programs. Okay, it's a disaster, of course, and that if anybody thinks you ought to be doing that, they're full of it. Let me show you something that's very important for making systems that can be extended in ways that no one thought of. Okay? And of course, that entails various dangers. It's something we all know about in an elementary case called generic arithmetic. Okay? Here's something you do in Lisps all the time. But you know, you have lots of things. Some people call it overloading of operators and so on. Okay? You say do things like, my gosh, I can add together. The plus knows what to do about integers. It also knows what to do about rational fractions. It also knows what to do about, oh my gosh, floating point objects, okay, they're pretty dangerous. Okay. Well, already we see that there's a danger with this idea. If you think that a program that works with integers might work with floating point, you're already in trouble. Okay, for the most part, that's not true. On the other hand, if you act that way, you're also in better shape than if you don't. It's a very interesting trade-off here. How many of you know that the average of two floating-point numbers is not necessarily between them? In fact, it's not necessarily even including the endpoints between them. Did you know that? Is anybody here willing to fly back on an airplane? Yes, you can, and the reason is because there are test pilots. Okay? It's the only reason to believe that airplanes fly. Okay? Anything designed with floating-point numbers is already dangerous. But none of the theorems that you think of that are true of numbers are true of floating point. That's already a disaster. However, the important thing to realize is that most of the time it does what you want. Okay? Most of the time. Okay, which means that if I've written a program whose job it is to do linear manipulations, like linear combinations of something, and it turns out that I extended to, I didn't think of floating point, and now I use it, it got there, okay, it'll do me the right thing approximately. Unless I've got some terrible disaster where it's not associative in a serious way, which it's not, okay? But then again, you know, well, here's a nice thing. Okay, you can see that there's all sorts of problems, right? The square root of 2 is this thing, but the square of it is not 2. The magnitude of 3.4i is 5, but the angle of it is this. If I make a polar number of the magnitude and the angle, by golly, I don't get the original numbers back. Okay, so floating point's a dangerous thing. Of course, here's a place where it's useful. I invent an idea like the mathematical sigma notation, right? It doesn't care what kind of numbers there are. There are just pluses in there, okay? And by golly, the sum of the numbers from 1 to 100 is exactly what Gauss told us, right, in his famous story, or the square of the numbers from 1 to 100. But I could also add up a series which gets me an approximation to pi. Okay, that's nice. I like that. Of course, I could be, you might notice a very delicate thing there. Okay, watch out. It's easy to get screwed with a generic arithmetic. Okay, by golly, if I left out this dot over here, okay, and put it in, just put a 1, and therefore I don't have floating point, then by golly, the thing thinks it's doing exact arithmetic, and I get an enormous rational fraction, which could take up all of memory if I don't let it. Okay, so this is a rational fraction because of course I can't express pi exactly. Okay, so got to watch out when you have power. Power is dangerous. On the other hand, I sort of like it. Okay, I like to have programs that don't obey rules. But hold on a second. These are all things that are already in your languages for the most part. But hold it. You know, generic arithmetic can be, why wouldn't you like it to be extensible dynamically as you're writing your program or even as you're running it? Boy, that's dangerous. Okay, let's talk a little about that. Okay, here. You know, you could generalize it. For example, it's perfectly useful to generalize to extensions over R to the n. Right? So I've got vectors. Okay? Scalar multiplication, all sorts of things like that. Okay? I can deal with matrices. Whoops, multiplication is no longer commutative. If I have a program that depends upon the commutativity of number manipulations and I apply it to something with matrices, I'm going to get a wrong answer. Okay? I didn't realize that was on. I thought they were just recording me. I talk loud enough so I don't need any amplification. But in any case, here's matrix manipulations. Division just means left multiplication by the inverse over here. Okay? Okay? But I can be even happier than that. I can talk about functions. Okay? You remember that, what is it? The sum of f and g applied to x is f of x plus g of x. Okay, so I can talk about that. Okay, and that's a nice idea, in fact. But I can also generalize even further, right? We can talk about operators, like derivative. Okay, my gosh, the derivative of cosine is minus sine, as you can see here. Or the second derivative, whoops. This is not multiplication anymore. Operators are different from other functions. They compose. Okay, so this is the derivative of cosine, okay, and that gets me minus cosine indeed. Or derivative of the x cubed is evaluated at 2 is 12, okay, just to see that sort of thing. But we can do better. We can talk about quantities with units. For those of you who are electrical engineers, what is that? KT over Q. Everybody remember what that is? It's 26 millivolts, right? For T equals 300 degrees Kelvin. Okay, indeed, by golly, you get things like that too. Where it is, 26 millivolts. That's an important constant in electronics. Has to do with diffusion versus drift and things like that in semiconductors. But however, we take the derivative, we can add in, we can mix these all together. We can deal with things with units. Okay, we can talk about definite integrals that actually compute nonsense like that. Okay, and indeed, we can deal with abstract quantities too, and it all mixes together. We can do algebra. Okay, so what I'm trying to tell you there is this is all dynamically extensible, dangerous stuff. Okay, so what is the reason why I should worry about this? Well, the standard thing they teach you in quote computer science is that you have to carefully prove the little properties of your programs, like in Dijkstra's little book, okay, which is full of typos and errors. But in fact, most of the programs don't work. But that's a separate issue. But you can look at those. They carefully prove all the properties. You put it together. You think carefully, and you're supposed to get something that works. The problem is that if you have to prove the properties of a program, then you're going to make it as narrow as in its applicability as possible, because that's the only way you can guarantee that you understand what you're doing. Which means that the structure you make, which is this tremendous hierarchical structure of CRUD, is this: you have to move the top a little, it all falls apart. Okay? If you make every little piece have an open set that it's solving of problems around some particular problem, then by golly, there's plenty of room to wiggle. Okay? So that's or at least you try to have that. And so that costs. What that costs is things like generic operators that I just showed you. That cost has the property that it's guaranteed that you're not going to be able to prove any properties of that.
Jerry?
Yes, sir.
You've just proven the theory of everything just to say you like duck typing.
Like what?
Duck typing.
Duck typing.
Duck typing is
duck typing.
If it looks like a duck.
Oh. No, that's not quite true. I'm not going to say that at all. Okay? No, I actually don't think that. I never heard the word duck typing, by the way. I think of duck. I'm more interested in duct tape. Okay, which is more interesting. Okay? You can do an awful lot with duct tape. But what I'm really talking about is something I'll call paranoid programming, which gets you around this whole business. Okay? Okay? And what paranoid programming is a style of programming which has whereby every little piece of program is sitting there saying, it ain't gonna be my fault. Okay? That is, it's vastly more general than it needs to be. Okay, it may have a normal path that's because everybody expects it to be used in a particular way. But, for example, if somebody wants to look at a particular object which is claimed to be a directory, well, is it a directory? Maybe it's not. But maybe it's a link to a directory. I better check that out. Okay, I have to have ways of doing generic coercions to the thing something ought to be. Okay, I have to make things that are good. The system's not going to crash because of that problem. Okay, now that kind of thinking is not unusual in most of science. I'm going to close up very shortly here. I'm going to let RMS start talking because he wants to, and he's about the right time, and I talk fast. Okay, consider the fact that in mechanics, we have many ways of thinking about something. It's called degeneracy in biology. The fact in biology that I can, if I lose the ability to process lactose, I don't die. Okay, there are many other I may have trouble with gas, okay, but I won't die, and I can eat other things, okay. If it turns out that a finger is injured, I can pick up the chalk with the other hand, okay, until the finger heals, okay. There are many ways to solve a problem, and it's not the same as redundancy. This is not that there are multiple, like a kidney has lots of redundant tubules. They're all the same, but there are more than one way to solve a problem that's really distinctly different. That's called degeneracy. And look, if we have, in classical mechanics, we have at least three ways of describing problems. This is the vectoral mechanics of Newton. There's Hamiltonian, Lagrangian, variational forms of mechanics. They're not all good for the same problem. In fact, the variational mechanisms don't work on things that have dissipation, like friction. On the other hand, the Newtonian thing doesn't expose the symmetries of the universe. It doesn't give you theorems like Noether's theorem and stuff like that, which says that for each symmetry, there is a continuous symmetry, there is a conservation law. Okay? And it doesn't take advantage of the conservation principles. When they agree, they get the same answer. Scientists are used to having degeneracy, doing many things, something in many different ways, and being willing to try that way. Okay? So I think that we should start writing our programs like that. We want to write our programs to have interchangeable parts and be highly degenerate. Okay? And that's it for me for today. Okay? Yes, sir.
You have a lot of lectures out on the internet. I've seen.
Oh, so look loud. People may want to hear what you're saying. So why don't we wait until everybody? There's a question here.
Okay. Yes. I'm just saying that you have lectures out on the internet, which are. I've seen some of them. There's a company called the Teaching Company of Publishers Lectures.
And they've tried very hard to get me to do things for them. But since they're a proprietary bunch,
yeah.
I won't do anything for them. Okay. Everything I do is free to everybody, okay?
Could you repeat your last statement? Programs, great programs that have interchangeable parts and
are highly degenerate. Degenerate in the sense that they're in the same sense as in when we talk about degeneracy in quantum mechanics. There are lots of eigenvectors for the same eigenvalue. There are many ways to get that answer.
More than one way.
Yes. Yes, right.
Would you say Emacs is degenerate?
Yes, and beautifully, and that's why it's so good. Okay, it's yes. Okay. Anybody else? Yes.
There's SICP and SICM. Is there another one for biology coming?
No, I'm trying to get Tom Knight to write that. Okay, because I'm not really personally a biologist type. I like to do things in the I like the physics type labs. Basically, radioactivity and electricity and things like that don't come out and get you. Okay, biology, you know, I don't like biology and chemistry; they're too dangerous. But in any, but so that's okay. But I am interested right now. Jack Wisdom and I are thinking about writing a book on general relativity, which looks like it's something that's relatively easier to deal with than biology.
Okay. Will you make that free?
Yes.
Free license.
Yes, the current books are not free licensed. However, they are sitting there free on the internet in the sense of being available to anybody who wants to look. Okay, and they are in fact owned by MIT Press. We hadn't figured out the theory of this when we published those books. That was a little too early. Okay, we didn't quite understand it. But any next books I'm going to write are going to be free. Okay. Mm. Oh, yes.
Thank you. Richard Stallman, president of the FSF, will now give a speech on software patents.